call 503-610-6103. Go to xray.fm and click the blue donate button. Get your keychain. Get your groove on. People don't say that anymore. They also don't say get your swerve on. But you know what they do say? They say X-ray is a cool thing. I was forwarded a wonderful email that I will tell you about soon. It was really heartening. But for right now, call 503-610-6103. Stay tuned for Thank You, Democracy. Radio is yours.
Who knows?
I beg your pardon.
Welcome to Portland. You're so beautiful.
We're there.
Yeah, I think this is because of you.
I just want to throw out a thanks to Jefferson for this concept.
Fit the facts together. Fit the facts together. The ocean of facts, but you haven't figured out the drop to drink. Too many of the questions that occur to me are kind of stupid questions.
I can be stupid. Let's ask them and get it done. Get it done.
A play in three acts with a bonus. Act one. This show is called Thank You, Democracy. We care about democracy. And one of the leading writers on the fight over voting rights is here with us. He's coming to Portland in 10 days to speak on the Oregon Community Foundation stage, talk about his book. His name is Ari Berman. Act two. Charlie Hales isn't running for mayor. We'll talk to two journalists, including the journalist who broke the story, and talk about what is the state of play. Act three. We'll talk about the mayor's race. As a comic book reader, occasionally you enjoy superhero team-ups, crossover comics. Today we have a crossover comic. Jen Chavez of X-Ray's Five Quadrants of Portland will interview me about the mayor's race. And the bonus. It's the fun drive! Call 503-610-6103. Become a member. If you're one of our friends on the interwebs, if you're the SoundCloud, if you're the iTunes, you can do it also. Go to xray.fm, click the blue donate button. Become a member. We're trying to reach $2,500 match by the end of the day. Dollar for dollar match if we can hit that target. Hope you will give. Act 1. Ari Berman is a political correspondent for The Nation, an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His writing has appeared in The New York Times, Rolling Stone, frequent contributor on MSNBC and NPR. He is the author of Give Us the Ballot, and here is what the synopsis of Give Us the Ballot tells us. The book charts both the transformation of American democracy under the Voting Rights Act and the counter-revolution that has sought to limit voting rights from 1965 to the present day. The act enfranchised millions of Americans, is widely regarded as the crowning achievement of the civil rights movement, and yet 50 years later, we are still fighting heated battles over race, representation, political power, with lawmakers devising new strategies to keep minorities out of the voting booth, and with the Supreme Court declaring a key part of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. The author of Give Us the Ballot is Ari Berman. He is here. Ari Berman, give us a hello.
Hey, good to talk to you, Jefferson. Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here.
So, thanks for having me.
Counter-revolution sought to limit voting rights from 1965 to the present day. I want to talk about that. But remind us first to start, just to cue it up, Voting Rights Act, its key tenets, what the heck did it do?
Yeah, so I mean, before the Voting Rights Act was passed, just to remind people, we had a situation where only 2% of African Americans could vote in Selma, Alabama. Only 6.7% of African Americans could vote in Mississippi. And so African Americans were disenfranchised across the segregated South, and many poorer whites as well. And so what the Voting Rights Act did was try to solve this problem. First, by eliminating the literacy tests and related devices that had prevented people from being able to register for such a long time. Then it sent federal officials to the South days after the law passed in August 6, 1965, to be able to actually register voters. So if local registrars wouldn't register voters, then the federal government would, and thousands of people were signed up that way. Federal officials then stayed in the South to make sure that elections were not stolen. And over a longer period of time, what the Voting Rights Act did is it said to those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination that they had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. It was also subsequently reauthorized by the Congress four times, and it was expanded so that it, for example, gave 18-year-olds the right to vote in all elections. It expanded protections for language minorities, so Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans, other Native populations. And so the Voting Rights Act initially helped African Americans in the segregated South, but then it was eventually expanded to really help everybody and became the prime vehicle for expanding voting rights for all Americans.
So since then, despite maybe those of us who grew up in Portland thinking that there was a rough consensus about the idea that everybody ought to have the franchise, that democracy works better if more people do it, that we might disagree over marginal tax rates, over whether climate change is real, what we should do about it, how important free market fundamentalism should be in driving our economy or how much it should be limited. We have fair arguments on any number of subjects, but that there was some consensus that this was a democracy, that people had a voice. You describe in your book that this is no such consensus.
Yeah, I mean, the debate over voting rights has never been settled, and it's strictly never been settled in the South, that from the very beginning, the Voting Rights Act was controversial, and it was challenged constitutionally. It was challenged in terms of the states trying to resist the law. It was challenged by states changing their laws to try to thwart the power of the Voting Rights Act. So this has been a titanic struggle over the last five decades, and that's what a large section of my book is devoted to documenting.
Who and how come?
Well, so who initially was the southern states that were covered by the law. So places like South Carolina and Mississippi and Georgia and South Carolina and Virginia, they challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. How come was because this was about power, and the people who had created an architecture of white supremacy in the South wanted to preserve it. And they knew that if the Voting Rights Act was passed and implemented, that there would be a radical change in political power in the South, that white supremacy would fall, and that you would get many, many different people ruling the place. And so they resisted it by any means necessary. And that's why the vote has always been so contested, because it is about political power. And that's why it was always the chief example, or the chief achievement of the civil rights movement. The goal was always to get the ballot. That's why Martin Luther King said, "Give us the ballot," because that was what would give people the power to change their circumstances.
So what's happened since? Talk to us about the counter-revolution.
Well, a lot has happened since. The Voting Rights Act was challenged initially, then it was upheld as constitutional. Then what happened is states began changing their election laws to make it harder for newly registered African Americans to be able to register, vote, and run for office. That was then challenged, and the Supreme Court again upheld the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. Then there was an effort to challenge the law through the legislative process. So, as I mentioned, parts of the Voting Rights Act were temporary and had to be reauthorized, and there was an effort to not reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. That failed. The Voting Rights Act was reauthorized four times by the Congress, most recently in 2006 by a vote of 390-33 in the House and 98-0 in the Senate, and signed by President George W. Bush. And so really since 2006, the effort has been to challenge the Voting Rights Act in the courts by conservative activists. And so the Supreme Court overturned a key part of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, that part of it that compelled those states with the longest history of voting discrimination to approve their voting changes with the federal government.
So the question I had prepared to ask you was, is there a war on voting? Is there a war on democracy? And I was going to ask that question with a preamble that said, I sometimes grumble over the use of there's a war on blank, with a potential critique that it's hyperbole for purpose of cable news chatter. And yet here, it feels like there is. But what it sounds like you're saying is, yes, there might be a war on voting, but that war hasn't ended and it didn't just start.
Yeah, well, I mean, my first article about voting rights was called The GOP War on Voting. So I'm firmly in the war on voting camp by virtue of that article alone. What I looked at in that Rolling Stone article in 2011 was the fact that there was a wave of new efforts introduced following the 2010 election to make it harder to vote. And those were things like shutting down voter registration drives and cutting early voting and requiring strict voter ID to cast the ballot and disenfranchising ex-felons and purging the voting rolls. And if you look at just what happened following 2010, there were 180 new voting restrictions introduced in 41 states from 2011 to 2012, and half the states in the country passed new laws making it harder to vote. And so that was a new wave in terms of the war on voting. That was your dramatic escalation in terms of attempts to make it harder to vote. And I think it was done as a reaction to Barack Obama's election, to try to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative, as opposed to younger, more diverse, and more progressive. And so while it's absolutely true that there have been efforts since 1965, and obviously well before 1965, to restrict voting rights, the movement to restrict voting rights has increased dramatically in the last few years. And that's why I think it's clear that there is a war on voting, or at least some people's voting rights, happening in the country today.
What are the three most important restrictions that people are fighting over now?
Well, it's hard to pick three.
What are the 100 most?
I would make it thematically. The first thing people are fighting over is the very right to register. That you have states that, like Florida, that have shut down voter registration drives by making it so onerous to do so. You have places like North Carolina that have rolled back and eliminated same-day voter registration, so the ability to show up, register, and vote on the same day, which dramatically increases voter turnout. So that's registration. So even just getting into the political process is being challenged. Then what is being challenged is how you are able to vote. So the amount of time you have and what the process will be like. And many states have cut back on early voting, which was a reform designed to make voting a lot more convenient. But instead, we've seen places like Florida and Ohio and Georgia cut back on their early voting period. So there's less time to vote, which means longer lines at the polls and more problems. The third thing we're seeing is restrictions over what you need to do to be able to cast the ballot, the documentation you need to cast the ballot. And all of these states are now requiring strict forms of voter ID to cast the ballot that you've never needed before. And the issue there is, in a place like Texas, 600,000 registered voters don't have a form of government-issued ID. That's about 5% of the electorate. Moreover, they need underlying documentation to get that ID, such as a birth certificate. That costs money. If you were born at home in the segregated South, like many people in Texas were, you never even had a birth certificate, so then you have to jump through more legal hoops. Texas, for example, doesn't have driver's license offices, DMVs, in 31 counties, in a third of counties in the state. So, I mean, if you live in rural Texas and you don't drive or you have an expired driver's license, how are you supposed to get to an adjoining rural county in a huge state with no public transportation? So I think those are the three biggest fights about voting that we're seeing now. There's others, but I think those are the major ones.
So let's talk about the rhetorical battle, and then I want to talk about also the politics of it. But about the rhetorical battle, what can we say about motive? So the way you would describe it, and by the way, I think probably the way I have described it on this show, is that it's pretty obvious. It's a bunch of people who gain more power if fewer people are enfranchised, if fewer people have a voice, and it seems pretty obvious. However, when I have that debate, and it's an argument I love to have, I think this is a winning issue. I think staffers should tell their elected official employers that they should run on this kind of stuff. It's a winning issue. But the democracy is good. It's one of the fundamental ideas. But the counter argument I would get from, let's say, Betsy Johnson here in Oregon, who's a state senator, when she would resist initially maybe ultimately like online voter registration, and she probably voted yes on that one, or changing same day making it so we could do same day registration, any of the many voter advancements that have been done in Oregon, the bus project has led on, et cetera. She would say, she would don the mantle, and I pick on her only because this conversation is real and not hypothetical. She would don the mantle of protecting democracy. Now, I'm not here to limit the franchise. I want to make sure we are not engaging in fraudulent activities, that people actually take it seriously, or that we don't want idiots to vote. Like, we want to make sure, because I honor democracy. It's not about power. I want to honor it. How would you say they're wrong, and or what proof do we have about motive, or just what your response is?
Well, the first thing I would say is that voter fraud is an extremely rare problem in American elections, and one that we already have safeguards built in to deal with, particularly when it comes to voter impersonation, which is the kind of fraud that you hear most often discussed, and the only type of fraud that would be stopped by a voter ID law.
Yeah, I wish it would be nice if there was such a cascade of energy towards democracy that overvoting was our problem. Overvoting doesn't always tend to be our problem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The thing about voter impersonation is that there's been 1 billion votes cast since 2000 and only 31 cases of impersonation, because it's an...
Give me those numbers again.
1 billion votes cast since 2000 and only 31 cases of voter impersonation.
So it's not one in a billion. You're wrong. It's not one in a billion. It's 31 in a billion.
It's 31
so what's
in a
your
billion,
beef?
Which will still break your calculator if you try to do it.
Not if you turn it sideways. Here's the thing I've learned on my iPhone. If I keep it like lengthwise, then I can't enter many numbers. But I turn it sideways.
Maybe you get the biggest iPhone.
I do have the biggest one, and it turns, and then it turns all of a sudden into a graphic.
It's practically a tablet. But the thing is, so what I would say is that it's not because people are trying to do it. It's that because it's such a dumb and inefficient way to try to steal an election that no one would do it.
Right.
So I'm not seeing this widespread evidence of fraud to necessitate all of these new restrictions.
It approaches zero.
It's working pretty well as is. The second thing I would say is that there's a long history of people restricting the right to vote for ostensibly very good reasons. The founding fathers had perfect justification for restricting the right to vote only to white male property owners in 1787. But that doesn't mean it was a good idea. The people that passed literacy tests and poll taxes came up with all sorts of rationales for why you should exclude illiterate voters, quote-unquote ignorant voters, all sorts of people who couldn't be trusted with the ballot. That doesn't mean that it was right or it was justified. When women were given the right to vote in 1920, that was a right almost exclusively enjoyed by white women. That didn't mean that other women weren't qualified to vote. It just meant that they couldn't vote in practice. So I'm extremely weary of arguments about why we should restrict voting rights, given our country's very long and unfortunate history of doing just that.
And I think people at this point get it. Like, I think that it was that more and more I am seeing out there and hearing out there that people kind of get it. For a while, it seemed like it was an issue up for debate. And now, really, the only people I hear with a really straight face say, oh, yeah, we should restrict access to the ballot are folks who have power to be gained by that. But let me tug on something else that's kind of related. So I was speaking at Pomona, and I used to go and speak there every year. And a student, and he came each year, like maybe only twice, but maybe over 3 years. And he and I would come down and talk about democracy. And we would have essentially the same argument each time, where he would make an argument, essentially a synonym of, but we don't really want the stupid people to vote. Right, we don't really want people who are ignorant to vote. You're here, Jeff, talking about democracy, trying to engage young people in the political process, and we don't really want the people who don't care as much to vote, do we? And my argument was manyfold. Yes, we do. There isn't an indication that like this young person is actually going to be a dumber than average, or certainly not the dumbest voter or the least informed voter. But here was the argument that I liked best, that I would love for somebody. I want your argument, but I'm going to lobby you for a moment, because I want the following study done. I have a hypothesis that is not yet a theory. And that is that, in fact, the exercise of the Democratic franchise, that voting, in fact, works on informing voters. That when I vote, I pay more attention. I didn't say that when I pay more attention, I vote. I said the converse of that, that when I cast a ballot, if the only thing I were to do is go in and have the voter's pamphlet in front of me and cast a ballot, at that moment and every moment going forward, I would pay more attention, I would be a more informed voter, and we would overall have a more informed electorate. Right. And so this is my hypothesis. And by the way, I would bet lots of money that my hypothesis is right. But nobody has yet done a study on this. What is your response to the argument of we only want the smart people to vote?
Well, that's the exact same argument that was used during Jim Crow to justify things like poll taxes and literacy tests. They were not exclusively defended on racial grounds. They were defended on the fact that we didn't want these ignorant or these illiterate people or whomever voting, and those were code words for maintaining white supremacy. And so I don't know who's to be the judge of whether you're an intelligent voter or not. I just know that this has historically been a way to try to restrict the electorate. The second thing I'll say is that I think you're right that voting makes people more educated and more aware, and I'll take it further. There are people that don't believe that ex-felons should have voting rights either, that even after they've served their time and been released, that they should not get the right to vote, which begs the question, why are you releasing them at all if you're not going to give them full citizenship back? But what studies have shown is that ex-felons who do get their voting rights back are less likely to go back to jail because they feel more like productive citizens. Now, obviously, people, if we give someone their voting rights, doesn't mean like they're just all of a sudden not going to commit another crime, but it does mean they're less likely to. And so the vote has a power beyond just voting. It makes people feel like citizens. And I think that the vote is also an evolutionary process. You might not know a lot when you vote when you're 18, but you're going to know more when you're 22 and 26 and in the decades more. You're going to become a more informed voter. And if you're prevented from voting in your first election or your middle election or your last election, you're much, much less likely to want to come back and do it again. And thus starts a vicious cycle of non-participation. So many good reasons have been given to restrict voting rights, but ultimately that's what's contributed to so many of the problems that we've had with democracy over the years.
Ari Berman is the author of Give Us the Ballot. He is in town in 10 days, November 7th, 11 a.m., Oregon Community Foundation stage at the Miller Gallery in the Portland Art Museum. Again, November 7th, 11 a.m. Ari, anything you want to plug?
No, I would just urge people to come see me at the Wordstock Festival. It's being relaunched. It should be a good talk, and I'm looking forward to coming to Portland for my first time. So I'm excited about that, and thank you, Jefferson, and for all the people in Portland for the good work you're doing, and glad it's spreading elsewhere.
Thanks for being on. I hope we have a chance to connect when you're here.
Absolutely. That sounds good.
You listen to X-Ray. X-Ray.fm, KXRY, 107.1 FM, 91.1 FM. That was Act 1. Act 2, Charlie Hales isn't running for mayor. We're going to talk to two of Portland's leading journalists, including the journalist who broke the story. And right now, I'm going to ask you, because it's a fun drive, to call 503-610-6103. 503-610-6103. And become a member of X-Ray. Make a donation. Go to xray.fm and click the blue donate button. We've got a match for all the donations we get today, dollar for dollar. So hoping you will help us get to that match. I also want it so that this show at least has a few people who say, oh yeah, that show's worth doing. We should have some sort of local chatter on what's going on, and it doesn't suck oh so terribly. And I hope you'll give. Now, it's time for Act Two. Charlie Hales isn't running for mayor. That story was broken by Andrew Thien, City Hall Watch, the Oregonian. Andrew is with us. Andrew, tell us what you learned.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jefferson. Well, it was a little surprise news for all of us. Monday morning, was expecting to have just a little conversation with some of the mayor's staffers about housing, and ended up learning that the mayor would be not running for re-election. So it was a strange start to the week, and here we are.
Any rumblings prior?
I hadn't heard anything. You're looking at campaign contributions. We'd reported this, as had other outlets, that, you know, the mayor wasn't bringing in as much campaign cash as Ted Wheeler. Was I expecting that he wasn't up for the challenge? I can't say that I was. The mayor seemed to be in campaign mode in recent weeks, rolling out several different policies, declaring a housing emergency, the demolition tax, talking to his staffers, that stuff that they had in the works previously, they said. But still, it, from the outside, looked like the mayor was ready for what was expected to be a big-time challenge next year.
On the line, we also have Dirk Vanderhart of the Portland Mercury. Dirk, how you doing?
Hey, good, Jefferson.
So with both of you, thank you guys so much for being here. With both of you, I want to ask some of the basic questions, and which include speculation about how come, which is nothing more than really cocktail party chatter, but might be somewhat interesting and might be somewhat informative. Second, what it might mean now, and then also talking about looking forward. Dirk, did this... So I hadn't heard any rumblings. I was surprised, like most other people. And I have made sense of it since. Okay, I have my own thoughts. But what is your impression? Did you hear rumblings, or and how much did it surprise you?
No one heard rumblings. Everyone was shocked, with the exception of his staff, who had been considering it or hearing about it for weeks, at least his close staff. Mm-hmm. I know at least one other city commissioner had advance notice of a couple days that this was a very serious consideration, though. He didn't know how soon it was going to come. But I think, you know, outside of that very limited inner circle, everyone is shocked. And I think for people looking from the outside, the most immediate thing that jumps to their minds frequently is polling. Ted Wheeler's campaign came out with some numbers that they didn't really back up with, you know, what the exact poll or questions they were asking. But they came out with numbers that said, you know, Ted stood a good shot, even might be in the lead. And so there's a lot of speculation that Hale's own internal polling showed a mountain that he couldn't climb. He is denying that outright, and that is something that we are not probably going to be privy to unless someone leaks these numbers at some point and they exist. But I feel like that's where many people are going immediately with this. Hales has also said, and is upfront about saying, there's not a black mark coming out against him. There's no scandal that he thinks is going to hit the papers. Obviously, if there was, he might not be so forthcoming. But, you know, he's hitting the marks pretty forcefully that this was his own call and sort of his own conscience.
Andrew Thien, play this parlor game with us. What has been either your information or your speculation about how come?
I want to go back a few weeks, actually, because the mayor said that he's been mulling this topic over for a couple weeks, and Dirk alluded to that as well. Friday, October 16th, I was over in City Hall in that early afternoon, and the mayor was headed down to Ashland, and it seemed in retrospect, I hate to do that, but that something was weighing on his mind. He then on Monday told me that he and his wife Nancy spent...
What day was this? How long ago was this?
This was the 16th of October. In my interview with the mayor, he said, look, I've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks, the entire drive down to Ashland with Nancy. We talked about whether this is the best cause of action, running for re-election. They talked about it down there. They talked about it on the way back. In terms of speculation, I don't get into that much. What I know is just that I had no indication that the mayor wasn't running for re-election. If we go all the way back to January, in another interview, he said he wasn't yet ready to run for re-election, but he was already bringing in campaign cash, asking donors if they would contribute to his campaign. Again, there was no indication that he wasn't up for this battle until the last couple of weeks here, and now here we are.
So I can add a piece of information, not just speculation, to the pile, and that is that Charlie and I had breakfast on the 11th. It's the first time that he and I had a sit down other than interviewing him for this show since the election. It was the first he called me, some number of days before that. It's the first time he'd called me for a long time. And we had a pretty long conversation, and nothing in that conversation indicated to me he wasn't going to run. Looking back at it, it makes me take somewhat differently some portions of the conversation. But I find it pretty interesting that that October 11th day is only 5 days earlier than the 16th. That you mentioned, something he's been thinking about for a little bit. I want to move on a little bit, unless Dirk Vanderhart, you want to continue the parlor game at all, add information or speculation on the how come.
I would add, you know, there's this also this other component, which I'm sure you'll raise, which is that Sam Adams and Tom Potter both didn't run for re-election and both had their own reasons for that. But as I was hashing this out with folks in City Hall after the announcement, you know, one person just mentioned to me, I mean, Charlie's been getting a lot of flack lately for just about everything he does, and it started, I think, probably with the street feed, but people have been picking up on that and sort of hitting him for whatever. And one person in City Hall just told me, in stronger terms than this, you know, it's a crap job. You come into work every day and there's a new plate of crap waiting for you on your desk. It's tough. It's not worth it. You know, it makes sense maybe that he wants to leave. Now, that's maybe not as someone that's established and used to the system as Charlie Hales. That's a viable excuse. I don't know if I see it that way for the mayor, but that's also something people are discussing.
Well, he told me that it's different now. I mean, and I don't mean just recently. I mean, he told me a while back it's different now, that the media is different now, that the division between the wealth and power in the city and the voters in the city, the people you would typically go to for large contributions and the people who you'd go to for votes, the division between what they're asking for and what they're demanding is different than it's been before. And I don't think it's an accident. I mean, the Oregonian editorial said, well, it really is about the commission form of government. I think that's the Oregon editorial board wanting to advance the position of getting rid of the commission form of government. But I do think that it's not a coincidence that Tom Potter, Sam Adams, and Charlie Hales, each of whom had some accomplishments as mayor. Sam had a lot of accomplishments. But interestingly, Charlie Hales, one of the reasons it's surprising is how many times do you see a sitting executive who oversees an economic boom, who doesn't see a major scandal, then opt not to run for re-election, or with some speculation that it would be hard for him to win. I mean, that seems to me to be interesting. Andrew Thien, what do you, and I want to get this from both of you, what do you see out of in sort of the political context as you watch City Hall that would make decisions like this seem rational?
Well, that's a good question, Jefferson. I mean, look, Charlie was going to, in his estimation and his staff's estimation, have to knock on doors for 30 hours a week, or yeah, make phone calls to try to ingratiate himself again with voters here in Portland. That seemed like a tall task that he wasn't willing to do. I mean, I think it is very interesting that here's this mayor of this major American city who has traveled the world, gone to the Vatican, was trying to establish his green bona fides in recent months in, you know, what seemed to be an attempt to ingratiate himself again with more progressives in a race with two white men in their, you know, middle-aged former Republicans. I'm surprised as someone who's been around the building that he wasn't going to go through with this campaign. We have two candidates here. Let's not forget who haven't really faced tough, primary elections in previous races. So now we have Ted Wheeler, who's pretty open about the fact that he wasn't looking to be the mayor of Portland. He was pretty open on wanting to be the governor. Things didn't work out in that regard, and now he's kind of awaiting a new challenger, but is in pole position to be the mayor of, you know, one of the largest cities on the West Coast.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the next parlor game, which is, so who runs now? Charlie Hales has said to a friend of a friend of mine, you know, playing a game of telephone here, you guys are journalists, you can't do this sort of thing. I'm not a journalist, I can do this sort of thing, saying that he wouldn't have stepped down had he not had a conversation, if there wasn't another candidate. Willamette Week also reported that he had a conversation with Marissa Madrigal about running. That doesn't mean, those two things don't mean that she is running, but she has not been available for comment. Is she, anybody other than Marissa Madrigal who is, you think, sort of odds on bet to run? Deborah Kefauri has been speculated. Earl Blumenauer speculated every time this comes around. Any information you guys have or speculation you want to offer? Dirk, why don't you go with you first?
I think you're hitting the high points. So, you know, the journalists have been good in the days since this announcement of getting people to say definitively no. So we have Tina Kotek saying no, Nick Fish saying no, Tom Chamberlain today saying no to the Oregonian. I think when Charlie talked about this to me, he talked about a generational change that he thinks this might be able to bring up in office. That again lends itself to Marissa Madrigal, who's fairly young, at least younger than him and Ted Wheeler. People have tossed out Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, as someone who might be interested. I've not heard from Mike Reese. I don't know if he's a viable candidate in this. He was clearly mulling a run at some point, and you know he hasn't been much in sight lately. But I get to hear a denial from him. And Deborah Kefauri has been conspicuously absent from the discussion, at least in saying I'm not going to run. So her and Marissa seem to be some of the most interesting people in the mix right now.
You're listening to X-Ray. This is Thank You Democracy. We are on the phone with Dirk Vanderhart of the Portland Mercury and Andrew Thien of the Oregonian, talking about Charlie Hale's announcement not to run and some parlor games about, and not just parlor games to cheapen it, but trying to understand where we're at right now. I happen to think it's a critical time for the city, and so understanding elements of that feels like a worthwhile expenditure of time. Andrew Thien, anything else you would add? Any other information or hunch work that you have on the who might be next?
No, I think Dirk spoke pretty eloquently about that. Marissa and Deborah, to my knowledge, have not responded to any media requests. Speaking with Dana Haynes, Mayor Hales' spokesman this morning, he said on the record that the mayor did not endorse any candidates, period. So, and again, in my conversation, he used the word dynamic leaders who are out there. In political speak, when you say dynamic, what do you think? You think maybe younger, maybe a woman, maybe someone other than the typical candidates that we see here in Portland politics. But it's unclear to me whether the announcement was early enough to allow another viable prominent candidate to get into the race. I suspect as much that. When an opportunity like this comes up, people who are considering it may, you know, consider their options more quickly. It's a high-profile job. It might be a thankless job in some regards, but it could be a stepping stone to other positions, and a prominent, influential political role here in the Northwest.
And I would set aside even the stepping stone thing. I mean, if people are trying to make their life be about something, this is one of the, you know, this is one of the finest cities in the world. Making your life be about this, like, that is a worthwhile, most important thing you ever do in your life. And so, yeah, people will think about it.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? I would be remiss in being here with you, someone who has run for mayor. Would you consider running for mayor?
City had their chance. So has anybody talked to Mark Wiener?
I have not.
So
my colleague Brad Schmidt has, but I'm not privy to, you know, that conversation, yeah. And wouldn't, you know.
So
I'll leave it at that.
And the reason I say is because something I find is I try to do dot connecting, right? Mark Wiener, Charlie Hales was a Mark Wiener client. So was Deborah Kefauri. And Marissa Madrigal, also a Wiener relationship. So when, it was Wiener who was trying to recruit Mike Reese when he didn't have a client in the race. And then eventually his client became in the general Charlie Hales. I mean, I think that's sort of an interesting part here, right? I mean, Mark Wiener got his start at doing communications very Katz, has been influential in the city, has had almost an unbroken chain of mayors. He didn't run Tom Potter's race, but Tom Potter was Vera Katz's chief of staff over the last 25 years? And so it's, if I looked only at the calendar, and Ted Wheeler does look like a strong candidate, I would say, yeah, it's a little late. Right, like when I got in the race, for instance, I got in the race right after Labor Day, and there are a couple people who felt I was a few weeks late, right? Then now it's a month after that. And it's not too late, but it would be an indicator against maybe. But an indicator in favor is Wiener doesn't have a client, and he probably wants one. So that'd be my little nugget. What are you thinking? And I guess maybe both of you. I'll start with you, Dirk. One of the things Charlie said, and I relate to this. I don't think this is all like not everything a politician ever says is crap. Okay, and if you think about it, let's say you think you have even a coin flip chance of winning, right? But maybe you think you have a less than a coin flip chance of winning. But you know, to be able to flip that coin or to roll that six-sided die, you would have to set aside everything you have for the next 14 months, undergo all sorts of slings and arrows, and get much less done during 28 to 30%, about 28% of your term in office. Would instead say, well, rather than having a 28 to 50% chance of winning, what if I just take an entire expected value of going all out for the next 14 months, and as long as I have decent relationships with the city council, it's not like Congress where I'm a president that's entirely a lame duck, I get to sit in Congress. So I actually can sort of see that. It doesn't strike to me that the onion has to be peeled back. Maybe there's more there, but it's not ridiculous to me. Right. But I do want to ask, what do you think happens now? I don't mean with the race or who else runs. I mean for Charlie Hales. What does this mean for the city over the next 14 months? What do you think he can get done? And I want to ask both of you this, but Dirk, you first.
Yeah, well, here's what I like about this. One, I think you're right, and I think we can take him at face value. When was the last time a sitting mayor had a challenger that was this strong as considerable as Ted Wheeler? I don't know that we've seen it in decades, at least. I haven't gone back through. But what's interesting is this, and I wrote about this a little bit today. The last 4 weeks, last month or so, have been some of the most dynamic, I think, of Charlie's career as a mayor. Andrew mentioned the demolition tax. He's declared this housing emergency. He's talking more about gang violence. He's saying he will voluntarily recognize some of the city's lowest paid workers as union members, which is a complete sea change for how the city typically handles this stuff. These are big things, and when you see them in the context of an election, it's very easy to call them political ploys and look at them cynically and say he's just doing this to fend off Ted Wheeler. Now he's taken these steps, and I am really interested to see if he stands by every single thing he's done in the last 4 weeks, now that he is not a candidate but a mayor acting on his conscience and agenda. So I'm hopeful, and I think a lot of his city council colleagues are hopeful as well. Nick Fish is saying, you know, when Sam was a lame duck, they got so much done. Others are saying the same thing, that the housing issue is huge right now. The comprehensive plan is huge. I think there are a lot of opportunities for Charlie to get more done. And another thing he'll tell you is that he has more asks now that go toward his agenda, as opposed to asking someone for a campaign favor or to appear at a certain event. Now all of his asks can go toward furthering what he thinks is right for the city. So I think we do have an opportunity in the next 14 months to get stuff done.
Andrew Thien, give us a closing word.
I would echo a lot of what Dirk said. I mean, now housing has kind of supplanted transportation in the list of priorities here in Portland due to renters crisis, homeowners facing record high prices that can't locate in the central city and whatnot. So now you've got a political equation that could include the mayor, who's free of campaigning, Nick Fish, who might be a former housing commissioner who it might be more inclined to, and has already publicly said so, work with the mayor to further both of their agendas. And Dan Saltzman, who, the senior member of the council, also seems energized in recent months with his bureau. So it's going to be interesting. You have three votes right there on any number of policies. What that might shake out to be, who knows? I'm also interested to see to what extent the mayor campaigns for a gas tax next year. Obviously, 2014, the mayor and Commissioner Novick spent much of their time, quite honestly, flailing, trying to find a street funding thing. Could he revive something else, having more support from council members in addition to the gas tax? I don't know. We'll see what happens next year. It should be interesting.
Andrew Thien, the Oregonian, Dick Vanderhart of the Portland Mercury, thank you so much. And I got to give one disclaimer. The line I used in response to your question actually is a Trey Shannon line, who told me, he's the founder of Voodoo Donuts, a good friend, who said, Jeff, anybody ask you that stuff, enough. If you're ever going to run for office again, just say what I say. The city had their chances. So if I'm going to plagiarize, maybe it's less plagiarism if I cite, but I want to thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jefferson.
Thanks, Jefferson.
You listen to X-Ray. That was fun. Call this number. Become a member of X-Ray. It's the fun drive. You haven't done it yet. 503-610-6103. 503-610-6103. Running for mayor. Well, it was so much fun the last time. 503-610-6103. That's how to become a member of X-Ray FM and help us get to the match. Go to xray.fm and click the blue donate button. We are in Act 3. As a comic book reader, occasionally you have the chance to enjoy crossover superhero episodes. Volumes of crossover comics. Right now is a crossover comic. Sitting next to me is Jen Chavez. She is the host of Five Quadrants of Portland here on X-Ray. She's a contributor called Carl in the Morning, and she's going to interview me. Jen, we're going to have to go fast, huh? Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Welcome.
That's not to rush you. That's to apologize, but thank you for being here.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me and your kind words. So it was really interesting just listening to the last segment. Andrew and Dirk are both really interesting. And you guys spoke about playing a parlor game, and I want you to throw your hat into the parlor game if you could and give your insight on potential motives, because of course there's what Charlie Hale said, that he wants to focus on the work before him without the distraction of a fierce campaign, and then there's the fact that by all accounts this was shaping up to be a very fierce campaign. So to what extent do you think we can take his explanation for dropping out at face value?
I would start with taking most of it at face value. I think there's any political statement. Well, I don't want to say any political statement. Most political statements of something of this gravity are the public statement, right? And any complex decision has lots of inputs. Lemwick was trying to dig up a story to try to go after his wife. His wife had been attacked for some cake contest that was a non-story, that the that it was going to be a hard campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Gearing up for a hard campaign, it's not like, it's not asking, hey, would you like to be the mayor? It's saying, would you like to get in a fight for the next year so that you get to have this job again? And so I think that that's a major piece of it, and there's probably a lot of elements of that. But then the other is, and this is where hopefully we add light and not just heat, is that this does say something, I think, Jen, about where we are as a city. That being mayor of Portland, in some respects, if one goes into public life for anything approaching decent motives, right? Anything approaching, well, because I want to make the world a little bit better and I want a chance to do things, it is so attractive in so many ways because it's a wonderful city. It has some of the best people anywhere. You have a chance that all you need, as distinct from being the governor, where you need a Senate and a House to agree with you to pass stuff that isn't just regulatory. Unlike being in U.S. Congress, where you get to do nothing, unlike being in U.S. Senate, where you get to just try to block stuff that the House does, just filibuster stuff, that as mayor of a major city, you get to do stuff. You get to actually impact both policymaking and the bureaucracy. So on one hand, it seems really attractive, but we have this track record now of three mayors not running for re-election. And here's the piece. Oregonian editorial board came out and said, this is why we need to get rid of the commission form of government, because the mayor gets blamed for everything, but they don't have the power to fix everything. Mm-hmm. This is the Oregon editorial board just wants to get rid of the commission form of government for the same reason the Portland Business Alliance has wanted to get rid of it for a long time. It focuses and concentrates power. But it doesn't mean they're right. I'm answering your question at length. Is that okay?
No, that's perfectly fine, of course.
This is the first time we've done this. And I'm really ask one question, I will talk for 15 minutes.
As someone who does interviews, it's kind of hard once you're being interviewed. I can relate. But yeah, please go on.
So now, for instance, the Oregon editorial board said, the problem with the East Portland Commission form of government. Basically, you name a problem,
right,
and
the
Oregonian
that
is likely to say the problem is the commission form of government. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the primary problem. I think the primary problem, I think the primary problem is this growing disconnect. And I didn't come to grips with this really in this way until he decided not to run again. This is a new thought, maybe insight from me. which is a growing disconnect, or at least grown separation, between the wealth and power of the city and the city's people. That the generation of Bing Sheldon and John Russell and Mary Fellows and people who were donors, okay, whose values at important times matched the progressive soul of the city, that era is, well, there's a need for a new era. And now you've got the fossil fuel folks, you've got the parking lot magnates, you've got a new generation of developers who weren't around during the initial Portland plan, and people who, you know, a generation that knew not Joseph, as the Bible says. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a growing disconnect. And here's how that plays out, because I know there's other stuff we should talk about. Here's how that plays out. So you start running for office, and here's what happens, right? You start running for office, and you got to raise some money. And so you go to your friends and family, and you ask for some money. And you use that money to hire a consultant and do a poll. And the consultant says, all right, it looks at the poll and says, okay, you have to be for education, and you have to be against the street fee. All right, which is probably what the poll is saying. And so what you need to do now is in order to tell everybody in the city that you need to get $1 million. Well, you've already gone to your friends and family. You might be able to go to them again and maybe a few more friends and a little more family, but then you have to go to people who can get you $1 million. And those people aren't all Jen Chavez, right? And you hear
not.
And you hear a hauntingly similar set of things from those people. What was happening with Pembina? What was happening? Why didn't we build that terminal? Why haven't we developed West Hayden Island? What's going on? Why are all these homeless people on our streets? Why don't we put them somewhere I don't have to look at them in the morning? And you hear a hauntingly, why do we have this stupid commission form of government? I want to be able to meet with the mayor and that person make a decision, and that's what happens, and I don't have to mess around with a whole bunch of democracy crap. But then, and so you listen to that, and maybe, like Ted Wheeler, you come out and say, oh, yeah, the Port of Portland, they're really important. We had this thing on West Hayden Island we should have done. This problem with Pembina, we should have cited that. What were we doing? But then what happens is you hit the water. You hit the people of Portland. You hit Bob Salinger of the Audubon Society, who says, hey, wait a minute. That might have been what you heard at Vigor Shipping, or that might have been what you heard from Chip Hewn at Schnitzer. But that's not what the people of Portland want. They care about the climate change. They want us to be an exemplar on the environment. And so this disconnect between how you get the money to run for office and what the people want, and by the way, the Oregon Editorial Board and the Portland Business Alliance, they are firmly in a camp. The Columbia River Crossing, build, baby, build, right? But then you've got kind of an activist base, not as coalesced, not as organized, that will resist you. I think Charlie Hales came as a person sort of without a political, ended up a person without an obvious political home. Because he backed off on some of that stuff, not the candidate of the big money and power coalition, but also not really the candidate of the activist base. I will stop answering this question. That's the most important insight I've had, or at least thought I've had. It might be an insight.
So speaking about the problem of the disconnect between wealth and political power and, you know, citizens and voters, what types of voters do you think are most disenfranchised? Like what type of connection are you seeking with whom in a future government?
Give me that one again.
I'm just wondering what you're talking about, you know, voter disenfranchisement from a political system that is infused with lots of wealth and power,
yeah,
and opinion by the business organization. What groups of voters, what types of people in the community have been the most disenfranchised in this way that you think need a stronger political voice going forward?
Well, pretty obviously, it's been like people of color in the history of our city. Mm-hmm. In some really important ways. I would say in the history of our city, North Portland, East Portland, some of that may be kind of obvious. But I'll say something else that, maybe not cheapen it, but I call it a hobby horse, is that the most political power, this is what I did my little TED talk about, but most power is organized around particular identifiable interests, generally financial self-interest, right? I'm the Association for Beer Wholesalers. I'm advocating for the interests of beer wholesalers. That's most lobbyists that exist, mm-hmm. and that's their job.
So we may not have lobbyists for everyone in the community.
Right. What we need, like the Onion had my favorite article, which was which is American people hire high priced lobbyists. Right? And then the article was brilliant. It was like the American people realize they finally need to play ball, and this is the challenge, right? We need to build prices politics. We need to build political energy that is worth a lot, not for sale. The kind of people that are benevolently irrational, want to do some stuff, want to help out with some stuff, and start connecting those people together, right? And where that might exist, I mean, some of that is, I think we see with the protests that happen, that we flood the visiting progressive candidate for president who comes with the largest rallies in the country, with the largest peace rallies in the country, the biggest fossil fuel demonstrations is the word I was looking for in the country. I think that there is a progressive soul of this city that when tapped into can do marvelous, amazing things. We need to coalesce it maybe.
Okay, so on the progressive soul of the city, of course, the other meaty question is who you see stepping in, who you would like to see step in, who probably won't step in but you wish could, and whether you think it might be someone more progressive like Marissa Madrigal or Deborah Kefouri, or someone less progressive like Mike Reese.
So in my life, I have been frustrated by political division, really frustrated by it, because the biggest problems to me, some of which seem pretty obvious, there are only some people who think it's really a good idea to have, there's very few, in fact, who think it's actually a good idea to have huge wealth disparities. They might not like what it would take to do anything about that, but they don't really love the idea. I don't know many people who actually like the idea of melting the planet, and I even know fewer and fewer people who really believe in their quiet moments that we're not impacting climate change. So political division has been one of my great frustrations in my life. As I get older, more broke down, more of a has-been, I am, and so much of how I thought about this was, I was sort of the Rodney King of politics. Can't we just get along, not just left or right, but forward? And I still buy that stuff. I mean, I still think if we're going to move forward, it can't just be a fight. We have to get on the same side of the table and approach common problems. Otherwise, we got no chance. Mm-hmm. Right? If it's only a parlor game of who's right, who's wrong, who's red, who's blue, we're all going to lose. That game cannot be won. Also, however, I have recognized that power matters. And simplifying my own minor moves might be helpful. So at this point, I'm getting kind of simple. I want to support the most progressive candidate in the race who has a chance to win. I don't know that I'll endorse. I'm sort of a member of the media now. Maybe all we'll do is sort of uncover stuff. But I would love the opportunity to support a woman of color who wasn't, you know, Condoleezza Rice, but actually was going to do something to impact the realities for people who are being pushed out of the city. I would love that opportunity. I'm hoping that opportunity might present itself. I wouldn't hate a white dude with similar politics. Occasionally I was that person, but I would love that opportunity. I don't know Marissa very well. I do know her. I respect her. I know and respect Deborah Kefouri. I think both of them could be interesting candidates. What I think about it is not the most interesting thing. What I'll be asking, what I'll be looking for is, who are they listening to? Is this, I mean, the thing that we're doing here that I believe we're ahead of every other media outfit in the city is understanding, kind of connecting the dots between power in the city. And want a candidate who, sure, will listen to fossil fuel shippers, sure, will listen to the Port of Portland, sure, will listen to the construction trades and the developers and the Portland Business Alliance, but not necessarily just be the tool of that set of that coalition of power. So I'll be looking for that person.
Got it. And I also agree that seeing a woman of color in the race would be very interesting, and I would love to uncover more about that. We just have 1 minute left, but I want to hear what issues you want to see focused upon during this campaign.
Since we may only have time for big picture, but lots of specific picture stuff is within each category. The just sent out an email. It's the fund drive. Call 503-610-6103, 503-610-6103. Go to xray.fm. Click the blue donate button. Please, please, please. Thank you very much to Trey Shannon, who gave very generously. Thanks to my wife. And in that email, I said, to me, this city has been special for, other than natural beauty that we haven't totally ruined yet, this city has been special for at least two reasons. One is a measure of economic equity and opportunity, a measure of, as somebody cooler than I put it, it's been a place where you don't have to be rich to be cool. All right. And second, that at our best moments, this has been a city where the people rule. I want, as a city, I want our candidates to manifest those two things to the core of their soul, to think that their job is to open up power to human beings, and that that power should be applied for more genuine equality of opportunity and to bend the arc of history towards justice. What that means we've got to figure out about increasing rents. Maybe that means notice when you increase rents. Maybe that means a revamped Office of Neighborhood Involvement, sort of a way to do neighborhood associations for the 21st century, to engage people, not just around sort of NIMBY policies, but actually what the city is going to be, how we're going to get there. I could go on, but I hear music. What's your closing word? What do you think, Jen Chavez?
I am really happy that housing and homelessness is getting the attention it does, and I would hope that all candidates for mayor would show us how they would continue or even step up that